to just put some preliminaries on the tape. This is an oral history interview with Ben Rumpf. Interviewers are Joe Todorovich speaking and Martin Collins. We are at the RAND Corporation offices in Santa Monica, California, July 23rd, 1987, 9:15 in the morning. Okay.
As a preliminary, let's just quickly sketch out a bit of biographical and educational information. If you could just tell us where and when you were born, and then outline your educational training.
Okay. I was born in a town in central Georgia, south of Macon, named Marshallville, in 1912. It was a small town, and therefore, when I went into school, the school was somewhat limited for what I ultimately wanted to do, and this is why I determined for myself what I wanted to do at an early age, like the second year in high school. And then this happened to be Georgia Tech that I wanted to go to get my aeronautical education. I had to go to the school and interview them as to requirements, so that I could prepare myself for entry. And it turned out that I had to get my high school to offer me several private courses in math in order to get all the entrance requirements. I proceeded then, at about 17, I think, to Georgia Tech and got my bachelor's degree there and my master's degree there. Now, at the end of that time, one of the professors there was a Caltech graduate, and at the time I had contemplated going on to get a PhD. He recommended that I go to Caltech. I then toyed with an interesting thing at that time. I applied to MIT and to Caltech and asked them about support, scholarships, fellowships, or what have you. It was simply because I didn't want my father to have to support me in any more graduate education. So I considered them at the time sort of equal quality. So the cost effectiveness was simply who could offer me the best financial deal, and that's the one that won. MIT offered me just a plain scholarship, which pays only the tuition in those days, and that wasn't sufficient for me to live on. Caltech offered me a fellowship, which not only covered the tuition, enough work to cover the tuition, but also to support me during my remaining college education work. So that's how I chose Caltech, strictly on a cost-effectiveness basis.
How did you choose aeronautical engineering when you were,
interesting.
In high school? You seemed pretty firmly
that was, set on that. That was interesting because, you see, that was in the middle and late 20s in high school. Where I lived was a training field that was used for training for World War I. Towards the end of World War I, I was 5-6 years old, and I have some memories of that now. There's a lot of memories of that vintage faded, but I have memories of the Jennies, which they were flying over my house. I'd be in the yard, and Jennies, as you know, tootling along about 50 miles an hour, something like that, and at low altitude. And the pilots would always have their arms out this way, and they would see me there, and they'd wave as they'd go by and that sort of thing. And somehow, as even a very small kid, I got attracted to aviation. Now, I can't state that that's what caused me to later want to go in that direction, but I've given you almost a prenatal reason, not quite. Another thing was that my father was a farmer. He had planned to be a lawyer, But his father persuaded him to take over his farms, and he did. And he said, unless you want to, I don't want you to be a farmer. So he literally tried to turn me away from it, because he always regretted that he didn't get to be a lawyer that he wanted to be. And he gently says, do what you want to do. Don't necessarily think about farming. And I had an abhorrence for farming. So those are two reasons why I did. I had no idea what the final capstone of my career would be in this building and so on. And I obviously had no knowledge of what that would be. Aviation was relatively new then. And I always had been attracted to things new, is another reason. Mm-hmm. I can't give any more substantial reasons than that, I think. Why I wanted to be that, see. I wanted to be in aeronautics at the time. This is long before what we call a space age and so on, see. So that's why I made that firm decision early on, and I never veered from it until I got my education. Now, I got my bachelor's and master's degree at Georgia Tech, and then I went to Caltech for PhD. Now, in working on my fellowship, in my fellowship role, I was ultimately, after the first year there, put in charge of running the what they call the 10-foot wind tunnel, which was used not so much for research at the time, but was used by all of the aviation companies out on the West Coast. You know, the number of them in here, Boeing in Seattle, and even some of the Midwest companies would do their testing at Caltech. There were not many of those wind tunnels other than at Langley Field in those days. The companies did not have their private wind tunnels, as a number of them have later developed. So under contract, sort of, they would lease out, in effect, rent the tunnel facilities, and I was in charge of running it. So while I did complete all of my graduate work for PhD, except my thesis, my dissertation, and German, I passed my French exam, but I'd never taken it in German, and I had gotten a little lackadaisical about it at the time and says, I'll study for 6 weeks to pass that, and I couldn't do it. But anyway, that's an aside. I was so engrossed in the work I was doing that I really only completed my coursework, and I created a rationale for myself. It says, I will not have the ticket, but so I have the knowledge. And that'll be enough for me, and I'll go on my own at that point. And I've never really regretted that I didn't finally finish it and so on, but that's the occasion for it. I became engrossed, and I worked almost entirely on running this wind tunnel for the last year there. And it also was a tremendous entree into the industry I wanted to go into, because I became acquainted with all of the people in the industry that worth knowing from my point of view, say, and what I was going to do.
Did you have any sense of what specifically in aeronautical engineering you might want to do, or what types of things?
Yes, I guess, well, of course, I wanted to be well-rounded in all aspects of aviation, building and design, not operation. I mean, not the airline operations, say, but the manufacturing companies. However, the most interesting phase of it to me personally was the technological subject of it, more than others, not the management, but the aerodynamics. See, the wind tunnel is essentially aerodynamics, and I had great experience with that, see, and so I had qualifications that would put me in a better position in that particular part of aeronautics than any other. Although Caltech has a very strong, you know, what they call structures department at that time, all of the structural aspects of it. But aerodynamics was my ambition at the time, at least to start with that. And I was now up to about the time that the Spanish War was going on, where you remember German armies got a lot of training in the Spanish War before, just prior to World War II. So in late 1939, when World War II began in Europe, I decided to want to look around and go into industry somewhere, at least during the war, to build something. Okay. So I skirted around, and the best offer I could get was in St. Louis, it turned out, at Curtis Wright. And I went to St. Louis and Curtis Wright. So that's my leaving of Caltech in 1940.
Before we discuss Curtis Wright, I'd like to go back to Georgia Tech for just a second.
Okay.
Were you interested in aerodynamics at that time?
Not so urgently as I try to describe later when I was out at Caltech, because of the wind tunnel aspect of it, say. I was very captivated by the design aspect at that time. And the design aspect at that time was essentially biplanes and so on, see. So I did not have that single-minded purpose of a specialty within aeronautics at Georgia Tech. That developed only at Caltech as an entree into a job, see.
Did you have to do a master's thesis at Georgia Tech?
Yeah, I did that.
Do you recall what the topic of your thesis was?
It was on some experimental testing of a cyclogyro design. Now, I got captivated with a cyclogyro because it was so different from other aviation things. And do you know what a cyclogyro is?
I don't know what a cyclogyro is, no.
Okay, it has a wing panel here, see, a rectangular wing panel. And there are four or five of them around an axle. And they go out and they articulate. It's somewhat like a helicopter, except that operates this way. A cyclogyro, the blades operate this way, and as they go around, as they go advancing towards the air, they increase angle this way. As they get down towards the bottom, they tip the other way. They tip so that the lift goes in the same direction. So it articulates these blades as it rotates that way, and it'd be two of these on each side of the body. Now, the only cyclogyros that were ever built, to my knowledge, in the world were built in Germany. And that's where I, you know, got intrigued with it by looking at the German literature. Now, it turns out it was a worthless thing, but it was fun. And I've got the thesis report on the thing, see.
When you went to Caltech, can you recall who some of your instructors were and what?
Well, yes. Now, start with the president. Robert Millikan was president at the time, who I guess got his greatest renown in what, measuring the speed of light or something like that. His son, Clark Millikan, was a professor in the aeronautics department there. Theodor von Karman from Germany, you've probably heard of that name. He was the head of the aeronautics department at the time. Ernie Sechler, you may or may not have heard of, S-E-C-H-L-E-R. He headed the structures department. And Mage Klein, I can't even think of his given name. I don't know where he got the name Mage from either. He was a Caltech graduate and he was a consultant to Douglas. But he spent some time teaching design courses at Caltech. Now, Arthur Raymond, whom you've interviewed here, was one, but in a curious kind of way. He and a number of other Douglas employees came over to Caltech once or twice a week to teach also design courses from application of design from their experience with it. Arthur Raymond was one of those, see. So that's where I first met Arthur Raymond. And I don't even remember the names of several other Douglas people too and so on. Now, Bill Sears, I don't know, you may have heard of that name too, no, I don't know. William Sears. there was an article in the Aerospace magazine, AIAA organization.
Oh, yes.
He wrote an article in that, and the last one I remember seeing, say, and a complete aside, I have a lot of argument with him about it, and he's full of crock about some of it, but never mind that. That's an irrelevant aside.
He was on
the staff, as junior member of the staff at the time. He had been a student. He was, for a brief interval, on the staff. And that was about the total staff of that department. The aeronautics department only had a graduate school. There was no undergraduate school. And there were about 40 students in the graduate school. And this was the staff.
You must have taken courses from von Karman then.
Oh, yes. And he was a very interesting fellow. He twisted my arm so hard one time, I almost took a job down in Tullahoma, Tennessee. You know, there's a research organization down there. Is it Tullahoma? Somewhere in Tennessee. A research organization of the Air Force, I believe it is, down there. But Carmen and I were very close for a while there, and I took a number of courses from him, and I have quite a few anecdotes I can tell about him. So, to me, the most famous one was he was so absent-minded, he got in his car one day and forgot to pull his arm in. He pulled the door like this and broke his arm, see?
I think that qualifies for the best absent-minded anecdote I've heard.
That was his story anyway, and I know he had a broken arm, see, and I didn't see him do it. But
well, was von Karman then instrumental in sort of shifting your interest towards aerodynamics?
Yes. I never thought of it that way, but really I instantly recognized it when you said that. That's right, because he was, while he was specialist in a lot of things, you know, his greatest love, I think, was aerodynamic field, and the strongest element of the Caltech professorship there. Clark Millikan was the same thing, fluid dynamics and aerodynamics and so on, see. So that was another reason why I think I went in that direction. I gave a pragmatic reason earlier that, you know, it gave me a better entree into a company where I wanted to go, see.
Aerodynamics, especially at that time, the theoretical and the practical aspects of it were separated by a fair gulf in the sense that the theoretical side of it was so enormously complex mathematically and difficult to solve, the people doing research in that end of it, and then you seem to have a whole separate other community of people doing the approximations and the kinds of mathematics that one has to just live with, even though it's not perfect, in order to apply the principles to airfoil.
Well,
design. The theoretical or the practical?
Oh, yes. Now, yes. And I took a variety of advanced math courses just to deal with that, because that's what Carmen would do. Now, that was what research he was doing. Theoretical aerodynamics. He did that in Aachen in Germany before he came to this country and so on. And story goes that he did his best work on research at night at home. He was never married, you know, and he lived with his sister down in Pasadena there. And the pharmacist up near Caltech told a story. He says he knew that Carmen was working on an idea he was trying to get developed, because he would call sometimes at night, at midnight, something like that, and order a fifth of scotch and a ream of paper. And that meant that Carmen was good for the rest of the night working on something.
was Well, I'm not sure you had a chance to fully respond to Joe's question about the...
The theoretical, I haven't yet. I guess I didn't quite see this absolute difference that you're talking about between the theory of aerodynamics and the practice of it. Now, you know, let's take the theory of economics, take what's called the vortex theory and so on. Well, okay, it's very complicated mathematically to express, but the application of it is immediately kind of is seeable. You don't have to use the complicated mathematics to use. You have to use the complicated mathematics to explore the theory. And once you can sort of establish the theory, then, you know, the theory has some application. It's not an unproven theory, if you like, see, if you've got enough theory behind it, see. Although we had this wind tunnel, we could do some experimental work. We had a little bit of wind tunnels that could do all sorts of things like trying to test theories on turbulence, the turbulence that goes within the boundary layers on bodies, see. Laminar layer flow, turbulent flow types of theories. We could have such clean and smooth air flowing, we could get to the laminar flow aspect. We could actually test all of those theories in that sense in a little, you know, tunnel of 18-inch diameter and so on, see, that sort of thing. So I didn't make such a big chasm in my mind between the theory of aerodynamics and the application of it as you inferred. Yes, I did not, I was never a theoretician like Carman could be, see. I could appreciate and understand what he could elucidate to you, but I could not ever be the originator of that kind of thing. So I was never a theoretician in the sense of proving the theory, see. Mm-hmm. After it's proven, I can see the result. So I actually thought of my act work as application of aerodynamics in wing shapes, wing foils, and so on. There were designs you could create that would have more, the pressure distribution would be such you'd have more laminar layer than you'd have turbulent layer, and that would reduce the drag on the system, the resistance. But on the other hand, it had to live in a dirty world and get bees and bugs and dust and what have you, particles all over these things. And so soon they found out the notion of applying the theory of laminar flow to actual use in airplanes was a pretty remote thing. There are wings that look like there ought to be laminar flow wings in the section, cross-section of them. But when you test the body as a whole, and especially when you get to the full-scale airplane, even though it's higher Reynolds number, as they say, and the laminar flow would move further back, it still would get disturbed by the dirt, the mechanics, the, you know, the grease monkeys or what have you say, they'd walk around on the wings and they can't afford in the airline business or in the military even to clean them off so well. In other words, you're not living in a bubble as this kid was who was born with no immunities to anything and had to live in a bubble for his life, say. Not that, you couldn't go that far. So there is a separation between. To me, I never saw the notion of laminar flow theory being exploitable in a practical sense very much. Even though a lot of theoreticians love to play with it, see. Anyway. So now I don't know whether I've answered yet, but I'm trying to make it not quite as, I want to blur it a little bit, not as distinct, except I'm citing this one example, I think, of laminar flow things that were beautiful theory, but never could be worked because life didn't go that way.
So you, my question, you've answered my question very well. I could have rephrased it as whether you ever considered going into theory and working in.
I knew that was what
you
were just about to ask, and
so
no, I didn't. I had the opportunity. I could have, and I had a roommate of mine that stayed there and stayed with this named Stewart, Homer Joe Stewart.
Oh.
You know him?
Homer Joe Stewart was your roommate.
He was my roommate for a while, see, till he got married. I see, you know him then. So he did stay at Caltech. Mm-hmm. He became a professor there, and then later I don't know how he divided his time. I haven't even seen him in a long time. I don't know how he is now, but I think they're still living in Altadena over there. But he did for many years spend his time between JPL and Jet Propulsion Lab and Caltech. But he was more bent on it as a theoretician than I was, see. So there's a intimate pair, they were roommates, that went their two different ways just because of their principal interest one way and a principal interest another way.
Mm-hmm. Did you begin work on a dissertation when you were there, or did you just...
No, I never even got to choose a dissertation subject. No, I didn't.
Did you have an advisor there nonetheless, someone who guided you through the selection of courses and your general overall program?
No, there was no specific advisors I remember assigned this way, except when you got to a dissertation point. There was some latitude, but essentially what it amounted to, every course was a course that could be a component leading to a PhD or a master's degree. Now those that took there, that came there from a bachelor's degree and got a master's degree, they had advisors when they got to the stage of doing their thesis work and so on, for a master's degree there. But there's only a master's or a PhD that was being offered until you got to the stage of needing one that way. They didn't assign one from the outset, see. But as I said, nearly every course was applicable to a PhD, and you could take a selection from these courses to go towards your particular bent, like Homer Joe Stewart took much more mathematics from, I can't think of the, not in the aeronautics department, but in the mathematics department at Caltech, a famous English man, I can't remember his name right now, it was
we can fill that in later.
That he took courses from, more than I did, see, many more, see. But the choice was entirely up to the student until he got to the phase of getting into the dissertation business.
Just very quickly, who were some of your other classmates? Can you recall any other?
Yes. I don't know how many of you, maybe you suddenly sparked it, Homer Joe Stewart here, but now Bob Shira, and the name Shira is in aviation quite a bit because they're two brothers, George Shira and Robert Shira.
That's S-C-H-A-I-R-E-R.
Right. Mm-hmm. I first met George Shira, his older brother, Bob's older brother, when he was working down in San Diego at what was called Convair at the time. It's General Dynamics down there now. And they would do testing at Caltech over here. He later went to Boeing, and he stayed at Boeing till he retired, and he'd come down often testing for Boeing, see. And so I knew him well, but I also was in the class with his brother, Bob Shira, who later went to work for Douglas, and then worked at RAND briefly, and then left to go to Lockheed. Another man named George Mellinger, who later became the director of flight test work at what was North American then, and now is what General, no,
Rockwell.
I can't think of his given name, a man named Molina.
Frank
Molina. Frank Molina. He was a rocket man, it turns out.
Yeah.
And he and Carmen helped put together the Aerojet company out here in east of Pasadena. Bill Sears, I remember, but he had finished most of his work and was sort of a an assistant to Milliken and Carmen and so on in staff work there. There's another German fellow, the name I can't recall right now. And there was a Chinese fellow named Chen. Who was it that got into all sorts of clearance questions?
Oh,
and the Chinese, he went back to China, you know.
Chen? Chen or something like that.
Chen, was it C-H-E-N or I-N? I don't remember. I don't remember.
I think his first name was Chen Su or something like that, but he's the very famous theoretician.
Yes, mathematician, theoretician.
Country.
Yeah, had to leave, yeah. He was there at the time in the class. There was a Japanese fellow there. I can't remember his name, but since Iwasaki is equivalent to Smith in this country, I'll use that. I didn't exactly the name, but it's some common Japanese name. I don't know whatever happened to him. You see, of course, the Japanese were not involved in the war at that time. This was, see, I was there in the period 1936 to 1940. That cuts the time span of it, say. So, and as I said, in 1940 was when the war was heating up in Germany, in Europe, and it's when I left.
Did you indicate your sort of position was supervisor of the wind tunnel? Is that how you phrased it?
I didn't use the word supervisor. I said I ran the tunnel. I was head of running the tunnel, in effect. There were two or three technicians who were not students that were there to, you know, maintain the facilities and so on. But I was in charge of negotiating with the companies for the job they wanted to do, planning the work to be done, arranging for the other graduate students who were also on fellowship, say, to be on hand for work, and reducing the data that was taken to put it in a form. And finally, Clark Milliken would write the report.
Who did you report to as?
I reported to Clark Milliken then, see, on that. Carmen was not in that operation at all. I guess he didn't really want to. That was a commercial operation. He wasn't particularly interested in it. And some people criticized it because it was owned by Caltech, but it was used when I was there almost 100% by these companies. It's only some research project briefly might go into it when there was an idle time in there in the companies. But the companies took primary time use on the thing. And this was pre-war, and there was very furious activity going on in the military field, see. All things like the old twin boom P-38, if you can remember any of that from World War II. Kelly Johnson was over developing that at the time, I remember, at Caltech is where he did it, see. So it was sort of a commercial operation, even though it was criticized somewhat at Caltech for that, and it earned quite a lot for the college. It in effect, almost supported that school. Now, you see, it was a Guggenheim school, but the Guggenheim school did not give continuing endowments. They built a facility. As I remember, they didn't give continuing endowments. There were five of those Guggenheim schools given all over the country. Georgia Tech, where I first was a Guggenheim school, too.
Did you, how did you learn the techniques of managing an operation like that? I mean, you've got companies coming at you, and I'm sure each one of them wanted first priority.
That is partly on-the-job training, partly Bill Sears. Now, I mentioned Bill Sears. Before I came, and the first year I was there, I was one of those that worked in the tunnel thing but was not supervising any of it. This fellow Bill Sears, William Sears, I'd mentioned, he was running it at that time. But he wanted out from under that. So that's why about the second year I was there, I had observed its operation for a year, see. And of course, Clark Millikan was in and out a couple of times a day, and would write the reports and so on. He would look over what was happening. So sort of indirect kind of supervision he would give all the time anyway, see. And it was by osmosis, you know, there's no formal training for it, see. Now, I left, I said, in late summer or August sometime, 1940, to go back to Curtis Wright.
Just quickly on the window, were the, did the companies that came in to use it, were they charged like on an hourly basis?
Yeah,
that's how it worked.
That's right. All the staff to do whatever they wanted to do were charged, including the fact that there was a shop down in the basement, on the first floor, rather. The tunnel covered three floors. It was a vertical tunnel like this, see, and 10-foot throat. There was a shop down there that would get their models ready. They'd bring them in, you know, in a truck or something like that, and they would have to be, have fittings put in them to adapt to the tunnel, to get into the tunnel, things like that, see. And those were costs that just the cost of operating that shop and doing that work by the hour was charged to them. The wind tunnel time was charged to them when it was tied, whether it was running or not. If it was tied up, it was charged to them. See, if the model was in there and nothing else could be done. And there was a charge for the other labor. That's what in turn paid all of us graduate students in there. See, including me when I was manager of it. Say, and. Some to Clark Millikan, fees to Clark Millikan in writing the reports. Those were the sources of what the charges were constructed from, see, but all on a time basis and a predetermined rate that they knew about, see. The running of the tunnel and so on was all predetermined through how much labor we knew had to go in. It wasn't individual people working, say, and so on. It just furnished all of those services for so much an hour, $200 an hour, or whatever it was. I don't remember what it was, see.
And your contacts with these various industries were primarily through the designers? Is that primarily the people?
That's right. And not so much the designers, because, again, it had to do with my aerodynamics bent, because most of the people that came for those models as representatives of the companies excuse me, were aerodynamics, were from the aerodynamics department, because the aerodynamic phenomena about the airplane is nothing, dynamics and aerodynamics, things that had to do with the interaction of air and the model, see, it didn't test any structures, didn't test anything like that, see. Of course, the models don't, they were static models, they didn't simulate any dynamics. The people were usually aerodynamicists that came. And by and large, they were usually the heads of the aerodynamics departments in the various companies. George Shire was one. Another one whose name may be familiar was Gene Root. Gene Root, I didn't mention, is a cohort of mine, and he had been at Caltech, but he had left about 2 years before I got there, see. But I pretty soon got acquainted. That's where I first got acquainted with him. He come over with these models. He was at the Santa Monica place for a while, and then he went over to the El Segundo factory and so on, etc. Kelly Johnson, while he was a designer of aircraft at Lockheed, he was also an expert aerodynamicist too, so he served both roles somewhat there. But he was the man that usually came to represent. And there was another man after Kelly got so busy with the so-called skunk works over there, that Hawkins, there was a man named William Hawkins that later became a vice president of Lockheed over there, but he was a junior man then, but took over some of the testing. So they were either designer aerodynamicist or aerodynamicist, but there was some features of aerodynamics in all of those that came. And strangely enough, the one that I gave me the most attractive offer at the time was the St. Louis thing. And the man out on that was the chief designer, not the aerodynamicist. So, you know, I'm not, you don't pin me down to being consistent about everything in life, see.
Just one final question on the wind tunnel. Mm-hmm. Can you recall which corporations were the principal users of this service?
Well, let's see. There was Douglas, and there was Douglas El Segundo and Douglas Santa Monica. I say that because the El Segundo factory is mostly was Navy operations. See, this, most of these are all military things I'm talking about. So that's two I'm naming, even though both are Douglas. There was a Vultee at that time company. It's long since disappeared. There was a Convair. It was called Consolidated, I think, at the time. But anyways, General Dynamics now, down the San Diego branch.
Convair came from Consolidated Vultee.
I guess that's where
Air,
that, yeah, all right.
When they merged everything together.
V is the only thing that survived. Yeah. But there was, they had started the Fort Worth plant at that time, I believe, and so there was some Fort Worth market. That was from Texas here. There was Howard Hughes. Now, that's one of his races was in there. Now, that was only because the man who was the chief aerodynamicist, and it turned out was also a meteorologist named Rockefeller, was also consulting with and helping Howard Hughes design one of the racers he had. And that was the only reason. Howard Hughes never showed up in the place at all. It was just this fellow, Rockefeller, who had been a student at Caltech also earlier than me, than I was there. Then there was Boeing in Seattle. There was, now, that's the principle. Now, there was occasionally Curtis in St. Louis. Not Curtis in Buffalo, though, because Buffalo, in that factory, had a wind tunnel of its own. Even one time, Grumman from Long Island came out. It was some test work that I remember. But you see, by and large, most of them are sort of located generally on the West Coast. Now, there may be a few others, but those are the, what is to give, about 8 or 10 that came to mind.
So why don't we move on then to your, so we got, came to Curtis, right?
All right, we got
okay,
to Curtis.
Let me flip the tape over for that. This is the end of side one of tape one.